one of my favorite writers in high school was Sir Terry Pratchett with his Discworld series.
Love Pratchett. Oh, Discworld's so good.
And it might not see it immediately, but I would argue that Discworld is very, very Malifaux. And Malifaux is very, very Discworld.
If you've been listening to this podcast for a while, you know that one of the things I try to figure out is, what's the process like? And that's what we learned today with Josh Thompson. Josh is a freelance writer for Weird Games. He's written material for their Fluff, as well as for their RPG, Through the Breach. I found Josh's approach interesting, his love of the subject matter infectious, and I think you will too. A big thank you to two of our newest patrons, Ryan Sell and Kyle B. Thanks for your support. All right, let's sit back, let's relax, and enjoy my time with Josh.
Third Floor Wars delivers interviews, insights, and discussions about everything hitting the tabletop. Rule books, plastic models, dice, and cards in hand. Let the gaming begin. Tabletop games let you escape and unleash grand battles and regale epic tales of adventure with your friends. If you love gaming and learning from players, designers, experts, and creators, you are in the right place. Pull up a chair. Craig and Ray welcome you to the Third Floor and the Tabletop Talk Podcast.
Craig here on the Third Floor. Today we're talking to freelance writer Josh Thompson. Listeners who play Malifaux and Through the Breach likely know his work for Weird Games. You may have read his work in Weird Chronicles or his Through the Breach one-shot, The Price of Progress. So, Josh, welcome to the Third Floor.
Cheers, babe. Thanks for having me.
So, Josh, out of curiosity, there was a point in your life where you never knew anything about rolling dice and moving models and flipping cards. I'd be curious to know what your first exposure was to tabletop gaming.
Yeah, let's see here. I would say that I was a gamer preemptively to begin with. I think middle school, high school, fell into Magic the Gathering, things like that. It kind of helped that my first job was, I know these don't exist as much anymore, but if you recall those bygotten days with you have to go to the shop and rent movies and discs and stuff. That was one of my first jobs there. So being 16, 17, when I would get my paycheck, I would just turn around and buy, you know, Magic the Gathering product and things like that. Kept it in-house. So when it comes to role play and miniatures, though, that really started for college for me because I grew up in a rural area. And so MTG was the only way that we kind of connected, communicated our kind of gaming meta, I guess. But in college, that's when I started to kind of get into role play. In my later years, that's when one of my college friends came back from Adepticon from I think it was a War Machine tournament. There's this newfangled thing that he's very interested in, and it's steampunk and zombies. Oh my, hey, look in this Malifaux product. And so some of my roommates asked me, hey, can you paint up some of these for us? We don't have confidence in that, but we know you might be a little bit more interested in that. So I tried it, and I enjoyed doing that. I enjoyed the lore. And so after college, that's when I fell more heavily into it there. So that's kind of the quick snip. Yeah.
So the role-playing stuff. So what did you role? What games did you play?
We start with 4th Ed D&D. So I know that in retrospect, that's kind of much maligned for folks, not kind of considered the upper echelon of editions. But at the same time, the things it did, it got me into role play. And I think that's what
A lot of people can poo-poo 4th edition all they want, but it introduced a lot of people to role playing.
Yeah, because I think if you examine it in that snip of time there, what was kind of big in the gaming scene there was Warhammer. Not the other W one there, World of Warcraft. There we go. So that kind of whole, I just remember printing out all those ability cards and having effectively a HUD right in front of me. And just like for my video gamer mind, this makes a lot of sense here, but we're not necessarily using a confined system here. We're using our imagination and things like that. That was just far more compelling to me to have something that could evolve or try stuff that instead of breaking or glitching would actually unlock new gameplay experiences.
So you're a little bit older than a lot of my guests when they got into actual miniature gaming. And it sounds like the hobby aspect was your first introduction because people were pushing models off on you to paint and stuff like that. But I'd always be interested, how hard was it to start? So was it was there certain concepts about tabletop gaming that were a challenge, or were you able to pick it up pretty quick?
I think what resonated with me with starting with the role play, then going into war games, that was like a natural progression in terms of things have different roles there. And so instead of me being a one player amongst five, I'm playing all the roles of this particular skirmish level and things like that. That kind of made sense there. And I think a second part was where I feel I was kind of the most competitive in my video gaming would be StarCraft, your RTSs and things like that.
Oh, yeah.
And that's very similar genre there in terms of commanding armies and resource management. There's a lot of cross-pollinization. So I feel it clicked there. I'm not going to say I'm any good. I think that highest accolade I can claim, I got third place in Tyrants back in Gen Con 2018. That's been my peak. So I'm not going to claim like mastery of the game there, but I still feel like I've had insight that goes into our playtest days there, which we might talk about later.
Yeah. So I'd be curious. Obviously, a big part of RTS is like StarCraft is the resource management and learning how important it is conserving and using your resources at the right point in time. Did you think those skills translated to the tabletop?
I think 100%. Yeah, totally. There's so many systems going on there, whether it's the management of your action points, the management of your soul stones, the management of position, or what's the term I'm looking for here? Situational awareness of also understanding your opponent there, of what they're able to do and how they can counteract yourself there. I think that's where gaming is kind of the most interesting there, is when you have these kind of skill sets that bleed into multiple disciplines and are truly universal in many applications.
Gotcha. And so from my understanding, then you moved into playing Malifaux. And then when did you decide, or when did you fall into actually helping out with the playtesting?
Let's see. So my Malifaux start, I want to say, was the third book or fourth book of First Ed. So that would be like Twisting Fates and Storm of Shadows. And that was right when I left college, got married, had my first kind of career in Central California, and we were particularly isolated there. Honestly, me building my own collection there, okay, I've painted models for others. I want something for myself there, but haven't found a group yet there. So that's when I painted up our first metal models for crews for my wife and I there. And I say all that, and I totally forgot your question. What was it?
when did the prospect or the desire to do playtesting start?
So while we were in Los Banos in kind of Central California, didn't have a lot of connection. But then the second place, which I'm still working at here up in Siskiyou County, this is like my home area. My parents are like a half hour away. I have a lot of connections there. So once I got rooted here, okay, this is a bit more familiar, and I reached out more to some of my actual students and, hey, are you interested in role play and things like that? Yes, you might be interested in D&D, but can I interest you in this other system through the Breach? And so I had a fairly dependable play group there, and a understanding shop owner who had us in the back room there, allowed me to record and things like that. So it's through my students, actually, that I was able to find a nice interaction there. So it was kind of mutually beneficial to kind of show them that this community exists. This is something you might want to look into college there, whereas it served me for my own kind of DM FMing skills, and also provide Weird with playtest content.
So I'd be curious, Josh, what was first? Was Malifaux first or Through the Breach first for you? It sounds like Malifaux.
Malifaux was first, but we fell heavy into Through the Breach. I was one of the backers when they kickstarted it right from the off there. And between the two, my wife prefers Through the Breach over doing Malifaux with us here. So I really believe in the system here. I kind of wish we had more content in terms of like their system, their fate deck and things like that. I kind of that we just recently wrapped up a campaign, actually. I'm not sure if you're familiar, if your listeners are familiar with Avatar The Last Airbender kind of genre. So we just completed a campaign in that world, and that was loads of fun there. So I think it's a flexible system. It's really, really fun, and we've put many hours into it.
Oh, so that's interesting. You took the engine of Through the Breach, but ran a Last Airbender campaign.
Yeah, because that's one of the shortcomings I will say of Through the Breach is you do, as a FM with a new group, have this hurdle of, oh, by the way, here's what the setting is, here's the genre, and it's an interesting genre, but you're not going to communicate the history, you're not going to have them read up their own lore and things like that. It's a large hurdle to get all that done there. So I was curious to launch this campaign for two reasons, one of which is, okay, if I choose a different setting with a group that's very, very familiar with that, how will this game go? And then secondly, to test again, how versatile is the system in a different setting there? And so I put in a lot of work to, okay, there's just flat out no necromancy in Avatar. Just you can talk to spirits. The media might work there, but there's no zombies. Take that off. Same thing with firearms. There's no such thing as weaponry. They're the closest thing they have is firebenders in cannons and naval ship, but there's no projectile weaponry. So I put in a lot of work to set up the system to work here. Just a proof concept. Does it even work here? Is this enjoyable? But talk with my players thereafter, like that this is the most fun we've had in a RPG setting ever. I've nothing but chuffed with the end result there of that campaign.
So I'd be curious, because the way that characters advance in Through the Breach is very unique in role playing. Did you keep that in the Avatar setting?
Yeah, I pretty much, other than taking out some pursuits, I left everything untouched. So that they increased their pursuit steps. There were destiny steps there. The other big alteration was, how do I treat bending? So how I treated that was already the magic system in Through the Breach has, I believe it's called schools, where you might have hedge magic and things like that. I had a separate school that was the bending school, which forced you to play certain elemental immuto, which aligned with the elements of whatever bender they were, and also limited them to what spells they could cast. So the waterbender could heal or put up ice pillars, and then the firebender had illusion type stuff and burny whatnot there. And so it became particularly interesting once technically it wasn't necessarily Avatar. It was more the time between Avatar The Last Airbender and Legend of Korra. So pro bending arena was a thing. So when they became pro bending athletes, they made their own team and were combining their immuto and magia, just like they saw in the show. It was a blast.
I think that's the first time I've heard of somebody porting over Through the Breach. And, you know, the people that I talk to about Through the Breach, I've only played it as a player. I've never run it. But the system is great. All right. The mechanics are great. And some of the mechanics that we love about Malifaux over other tabletop games are present in Through the Breach. So that's very, very cool. So guys, the Insider Insight series allows me to talk to developers, designers, artists, writers, and industry insiders about their creative process and how they approach their work. Today, we're going to try to find out how Josh gets his inspirations, how he does his work research, and what it's like to work with weird games and to create compelling stories and adventures. So we're going to take a quick break. When we get back from this break, we're going to talk about the transition from playtester to creator. We'll be right back. So we got kind of an idea of how Josh found tabletop gaming and, you know, how he transitioned and fell in love with Through the Breach. Josh, I'd be curious, taking a step back, I want to talk about you more as a writer. When did you start writing? And when I mean writing, I mean just writing stories for yourself.
You know what? It's not the kind of pathway you would expect here, because I still, just you saying that sentence, what makes you a writer here, I'm still struggling to wrap my head around with, because if I hadn't mentioned already, I'm a high school teacher. I teach science. And so one of the reasons why I chose science academically and math, like those were my two main foci, was predominantly because I enjoyed them, yes, but English wasn't my super favorite subject. It's not that I did bad at it. I didn't really super enjoy it either. I think others can kind of have that same sentiment there. So I wasn't anathema to it, but I knew writing is not for me. I don't find it interesting or compelling here. But before I went to teaching, it was one of my goals here that, you know, I don't want to be a dusty fuddy-duddy reading from a book. I want to have interesting labs here, but more importantly, I want kind of life experience here. So before I go into teaching, I want to do a bit of kind of science life experience. How can I do that? So I picked up a few jobs coming out of college here. Those being, I worked for a stint at NASA Dryden down in Southern California. I worked at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in the Bay Area, SLAC, Linear Accelerator. I did some exoplanet transit research as a undergrad. So doing these opportunities, I wanted to feel what it's like to be a scientist before becoming a teacher. But it was that stint at NASA, I feel like that's when I became a writer here, because I was kind of broadsided that there was a high expectation of communication that had to be done within NASA right there. And I just remember one of my kind of core tasks was babysitting the TASS, which is the Telescope Assembly Alignment Simulator. It's this big glorified tube that helps calibrate their instruments. But the problem was it was still under development for this one airplane. No one had bothered to characterize the calibrator or calibrate the calibrator, to put it even more basically. So my job was that for a summer. And I just remember when the first reports I wrote up there, I put my heart and soul into it, and it was 5 or 6 pages long. I gave it to my superiors to hear, and the following morning, he's like, yeah, this is garbage. This is no good. This is not how NASA scientists write. Do this, this, and this, and send me the redraft here. And so I think that's a defining moment for a lot of writers there, is like, he did not hold back on anything here. But at the same time, he was a good boss. He was very communicative of how I can improve and what he was looking for. He didn't waffle around of what the expectations were. So that 3 or 4 page paper became an 8 or 6 page paper, sent it back, came back, nope, better, but still trash. Not good enough here. Do it again, do it again, do it again. So by the end of a like 3 month stand, I want to say that, you know, what I thought he originally asked for, a 3 or 4 page paper, ended up being about 25 or 30 page kind of really detailed report here. And I actually had a chat with him back in October doing a Zoom call with my students there. And he admitted, yeah, Josh, that report you wrote back in, that would be 2010, a decade later, we're still using that in-house. So
no kidding. Good for you, man.
That was it's not anything published. It's not anything you can look up here, but that was, I felt like I had legitimately contributed to NASA's efforts to kind of hear that and that remain evergreen there. So that process is what I kind of think of writing. That relationship I had with Zaheer of jotting stuff down, kick it over there, nope, not good enough, and just having that feedback cycle that's really brutal and really time consuming, but you really end up with really interesting polished products. So that was kind of my first step in professional writing, and that was entrenched in technical writing too. And that's something I really, really stress to kids. The writing you learn at high school or even college, the novelizations or plays or poetry, is not most likely not going to be the type of writing you're going to do as an engineer. As you're going to write instruction manuals, you're going to write down websites, you're not going to do these big epic J.R.R. Tolkien writing styles as a profession, but you're still going to write. So that I feel was my first step.
So I'd be curious, when, like, if you look back now, when is the first time that you ventured into writing fiction?
So let's see. I think that kind of goes back into, honestly, my first attempts in homebrew. Back into role play right there, where I might have a story idea there, but when done, not correctly, but I think when done well is when you fully accept that there is a joint storytelling, right? The DM might have story beat ideas, but not railroad tracks to just be this roller coaster ride for the players. How are they going to inject in here and things like that? So I think it comes from there, where like any DM or FM, kind of start with the pre-published adventures, then you might interject your own things of like, well, this is kind of iffy, or I need to accommodate the the honestly learning styles of the players here. I can't help but kind of connect how a GM and a teacher have very similar kind of core sets here. This is my lesson of kind of discovery. How can I get my players there, etc. Until eventually, like I said, the homebrew with the bravery to do kind of really complex things like the avatar. Until eventually, like I think I can jot this stuff down. I have a writing style. I think. Let's see what weird things. And that's when. I checked recently. I don't see the tab there at the moment there, but there every once in a while they have job opportunities, you know, track on weird there. It's the, again, I will always endorse how great Through the Breach is here. And I saw there was job opportunities for just being a freelance writer. And so it's like, well, let's send a writing sample, whatever they request, see what they think. And things just kind of tumbled from there.
That's cool. Well, it's interesting you talk about, you know, being a GM or a DM giving you kind of some of the tools, because when you think about it, when you're running a game, especially a homebrew game, you're controlling the pace, which is a big part of writing fiction, and controlling the pace and the set pieces and the beats, being able to start a story, have three acts, all of that, you know, is part of role-playing and running role-playing games. So I can definitely see where those skills would transition. So let's talk about the writing sample. So what was the writing sample that you sent to Weird?
Let's see. I'm trying to recall here. I actually didn't bring that up and look at some more here. But if I recall correctly, I think I titled it literally The Sample. And what it had to do was a professor in, I think it was Oxford, it was some college, and it was all about her lecture going on about the scientific approach of soul stones, because we get a lot of content about the miners call it soul stone because it magically charges with the deceased going by near it there. But would a scientist be actually happy with that? Would they actually be content with that explanation there? So is this whole kind of academic argument between the professor and her classroom there of the classmates arguing, no, it's soul stone. There's so much evidence there. And her arguing, no, it's all circumstantial. Correlation does not mean causation and things like that. And it ends, if I recall correctly, she gets special dispensations for the guild to lend her a stone to do her experiments and things like that. But at the end, the guild knows and finds out that when she returns the stone, it's a fake. Somehow during the whole discussion, she pawned it off and things like that. And but they know she did. How was she able to make such a fake? We'll let her keep on tinkering, da 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 da. And that was the close there, that they know that she know that da da da, and full circle like that.
Very, very cool. All right. So you get they accept the writing sample. That's a done deal. What's the next step? Once you are quote unquote hired as a freelancer, what happens next?
I'm not sure how other places might do it here, and they might handle different writers differently in terms of the amount of content come up there. But at least my relationship with Weird, every once in a while they'll ping me and say, hey, we would like a piece of fiction there. That was kind of my first piece there. We want something in Chronicles. We're kind of light on outcast lore at the moment there. Is that something you want to nosh on? I'm like, well, my first master was Leviticus. I really enjoy the lore of Terra. Let me see if I can work something up here. And being focused on science, particularly physics and astronomy, I want to do a Terra kind of time story there. And that was nice. Kind of my first launching off point.
So for those that have not read your Chronicles story, can you give us kind of a little bit of a synopsis?
Yeah. So we have two characters, Teddy, and I'm spacing on the second character here. This is really bad form for me not to remember my ingredients.
You should read the story,
here.
Man. I hear it's good.
Yeah, right? It's my favorite one ever published in Chronicles. Can't you tell? So I do distinctly remember Teddy because there's a story beat at the end about that there. But we just have two kind of splunkers going around in the sewers, and they find a piece of tech that they really shouldn't. And it's one of those classic timepieces where dial forward, dial back, it proves to be a time machine, and they see bits of the Tyrant War, which I was really, really chuffed with them allowing me to do that, because I know that's a very sacred piece of kind of lore there, and high canon of what powers do tyrants have, what scenes do we get to see them. So the fact that you get to see one tyrant, I won't say who, so you go and download and read for yourself. I was quite pleased with there, but in their time there, the sundial, that the device, that the tile of the story sundial, gets wrecked, and the two characters get flung into two different kind of broken time states. One is in a frozen present, and the other one is just in utter darkness, which I was trying to allude to. This might be one of the possible presents if the Tyrant War had a different result or something like that.
Nice.
And it ends with Aeonis coming by and repairing things effectively and having a chat with both of them individually. And both of them are trying to negotiate with time, and he's having none of it.
So where did the idea come from? So before pen ever hit paper, you go through your head and you try to put together a story. What were the initial seeds that led to, you initially at least outlining it or breaking it down in your head?
Well, the story I just described there has very, very little to do with what I first wrote down. The original story was, again, two characters, but it was about a father and a daughter and time things happening with them there, and pretty much the only similar story beat was the same ending there, them pleading their case with Aeonis when he's trying to repair it in a very aggressive fashion there. That whole story arc was a very, very close homage to, I'm not sure if you're familiar with Dan Simmons. He wrote Hyperion, and
I've never read him, but I've heard he's excellent.
Yeah. So Dan Simmons was recommended to me when I was student teaching. Hyperion in particular has, again, weird wibbly wobbly time stuff there. And I, that book in particular, I describe it as it's science fiction, but everyone's going to the Wizard of Oz, and each chapter is each character. When am I going to ask from Oz? And the really frustrating thing with that book is it concludes right when they get to the Emerald City. You don't get to see anything else there, and until you read the sequel. But
sure.
One of those stories has, again, wibbly wobbly timey wimey type stuff between again, I'm not quite sure how much I need to reveal here, because, again, that's a story that I highly encourage there. But the point is, a lot of the story beats I saw in there is like, this really fits for Obliteration. If I kind of steampunk it up here, there's some really interesting stuff that happens here. So when I submitted that to Weird, they kicked back and said, this is too long. This is too convoluted. It doesn't read well as a short story. Yes, playing around with Void Wretches and Aeonis, like, keep work on that, but this whole strange kind of time loop you're trying to do, it's not going to work here. So,
nice. So, stop for a second here. So, what was it like to get that feedback?
I honestly got a flashback to my time at NASA there, where the feedback was clear, brutal, but I was 100% okay with it. And that's something I would really encourage kind of students and writers and things like that, that honestly, having that kind of clear of feedback is a godsend. I can't imagine writing for anyone else there that's like, well, I don't like it. I can't say why. Just start again. Like, that's not very productive. And I'm just glad that my kind of writing experiences have had good kind of management there to give me guidance to be very clear. Again, okay, it's too convoluted. Here's the beats we want you to preserve. Try and fill in the rest there. That's what we need as freelance writers.
So you go and decide, all right, I there's some elements here that I'm going to keep. There's some things that Weird liked, but I need to just re-engineer all of this. So what's next then? Well, like, where do you decide where it's two dudes in a sewer?
Trying to recall my kind of thinking process here, I think how it evolved best was just me writing backwards, honestly. The part that we both liked was the ending, the culminating event right there. And so, again, I think there's too much of a kind of misconception is that you write how you read beginning to end, but especially in technical writing, but also in this kind of splash in kind of fluff writing there, that that's not what happened there. And so, okay, what do I want to see instead here? Well, if I'm not going to have this kind of closed loop thing, let's play around with time here. Okay, so let's see if they let me get away with seeing a scene in the Tyrant War and kind of the beginning of the Nephilim race there. Oh, they're okay with that. All right, let's lean into it there. And so I hope the folks I work with there at Weird aren't like agitated by this. What about this? No. What about this? Yes. Back and forth, because it takes weeks and months to do that process there. But
sure,
the end product I'm pleased with, and they're obviously pleased with it because it's
they published
going to print. So yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's very, very cool. And it's interesting to hear that process that you kind of went through. Now I'd be curious. So you give me a little bit of an idea of kind of the writer's table, right? The back and forth and throwing some ideas out and getting some feedback on it. But it's, at some point, you put pen to paper and you write the first draft of the, well, this is the second draft, right? You threw the first one out. What do you do before you send it to them? Whether is it something that you read several times, you give to your wife, you have friends, like what's that process before you officially submit the next draft?
Yeah, I do have a few proofreaders on certain drafts there. I'll have my wife read through it there, and she's far better with my punctuation and grammar mistakes and things like that than I am. So she definitely cleans up there. I'll sometimes show it to my mom there. She's an avid reader, and she'll give a proof there. And that's the thing, is I try not to share it with my like strict gamer buddies, like none of my college friends, none of my like current play group there, because I know they'll understand the references. I know they'll understand these names here, but I need to make it clear to folks that aren't familiar with the world. I want to make sure that it's a product that is a bit more universal.
Very, very interesting. So I'd be curious, Josh, for people listening who maybe have wrote their own fanfic, whether it be for Malifaux or for something else, but they've never gotten published. What kind of advice can we give them? What do you think are some good steps if someone is sitting here listening right now and maybe wants to take that next step and stop writing for themselves or on a message board somewhere and may want to submit it somewhere? Do you have any thoughts for them?
I'm not quite sure how to answer that, because like we're skipping a step here between me like writing for NASA and me writing for Weird here. And there's that really big middle chunk there of my playtest days. Like we playtested a lot.
That.
Yeah. So where we start here, I'm trying to remember the first book I playtest with here. It might've been the open playtest for the recently announced Malifaux second edition. I think was it's either that or the second book I want to say is, I'm checking my bookshelf here, Crossroads. It was one of those two books. And when you get into those playtest forms, whether they're open or closed here, I think Weird has improved in kind of describing what they want to see here. But kind of back in ye olden days, when we're talking about like Justin Gibbs is still on staff and things like that. Just, you know, kind of play your game, really be detailed about what you hire, but we kind of trust you to kind of narratively describe what happened, what do you think is busted, and things like that. I came in there, I was like, again, I'm not a strong enough player, and I'm not confident in myself to kind of find the busted combinations here. I do want to detail the experience in terms of, like, the fun aspect and the clarity of the rules and what the kind of middle-tiered, mid-table mediocrity feels about these new models and things like that. So I, on the other hand, and each playtester had different styles. There's someone stayed towards that. Some had really small sound blitz. Or the more interesting conversations were the ones where you'd have two playtesters playing the same game and they would have a back and forth on how things went. Well, understanding this model better now, I would do XYZ thing. Like those were really productive forums to read there. But my style was I detailed absolutely every single action. I noted when particular actions failed because of a flip or when hands ran dry. I took pictures of the table. I played both on Vassal and in the physical there and just did dozens of game reports like that. And that took a lot of time, But I think that's what put me first on the radar with Weird there, that here's someone that's willing to kind of put in time and help the process there. So when I came on for that, you know, job opportunities as a freelance here, I already had my own brand. I was already kind of on the radar. Oh, we gotcha. Know his content there. We know he is familiar with the models, familiar with the lore, and playing with my Through the Breach students, those were all recorded. I had a little sound record there. I still have them. I have no interest in publishing them or anything like that, but that was fully supposed to be in-house there. And so I would still have my notes that, oh, this ability is confusing, or this scene was particularly deadly. But I think that rigor and detail is what kind of already made me partially a community member, not necessarily community for the Weird community, because you didn't, no one has seen that work publicly, but doesn't mean I've been silent all that time.
Gotcha. So it was really, in some ways, you kind of, I don't, for lack of a better word, made a name for yourself within the playtesting arena. So the Weird was aware of your attention to detail and your familiarity with the world. And you think that that had an impact on their evaluation of your writing sample?
I can't see how that couldn't have been a contributing factor. Yeah. In short.
I'd be curious, because, boy, you've written in this world, you've played in this world. What is it about the world that you like so much that you, not only is it a tabletop game you play, it's a role-playing game that you play, it's a role-playing game you've written for, it is, you know, it's a part of your creative process at this point. What is it about Malifaux that makes you love it so much?
I've been trying to think about this for a while here, just kind of reflecting on so compared to the other systems I play, why do I still rank like Through the Breach and Malifaux higher compared to these other experiences? Because I didn't stop at 4th Ed. I went on to 5th Ed. I played Dark Heresy with the Warhammer friends there. I've done bits of Pathfinder and the weird ones like Dread. Why is it that I rank Through the Breach so highly? And its lore in particular. And what I've kind of come to conclude is, of all things, it doesn't seem like a clear connection here. But if you're, again, looking back to writers, one of my favorite writers in high school was Sir Terry Pratchett with his Discworld series.
Love Pratchett. Oh, Discworld's so good.
And it might not see it immediately, but I would argue that Discworld is very, very Malifaux, and Malifaux is very, very Discworld. And what I mean by that is, well, yes, one's high fantasy and things like that, but the satire that Pratchett wrote about of each book had kind of a core idea, and here we're following the Night Watch here, and here's Commander Vimes, and here's the Unseen University, and here's the Wizards bimbling around. And each book is, okay, let's focus on commercialism, and let's focus on racism, and let's focus, you know, he had each beat there. But it's been a little bit more recently, because I, again, introduced my wife to audiobooks during COVID and whatnot of his Discworld series. Something that I've marveled at, that I feel that both IPs share, is they're so broad in terms of the topics and the themes they examine, but at the same time, they fit together very, very well. And so a counter to that is, again, in these COVID times, something I've been reading up here is like the Sandman series by Neil Gaiman, another high-ranked author for me there. And
He's one of the best. He's one of the best there is, yeah, in my opinion.
So looking at those old 80s and 90s of Sandman there, you know, here we've got Batman showing up randomly and leaves. And here we've got this concept of how his dream world works, and then it leaves there. So it, he too has all these concepts there, but they're always fleeting. And that works for Sandman because it's meant to feel like a dream, and right, that like fits for that. But Discworld, on the other hand, we just finished listening to Raising Steam. So we had Moise von Lipwig, the entrepreneur, trying to establish a locomotive, but he's also interacting with Vimes and also talking with Vetinari on what is the political nature of having a railway system. We have to talk with these other nations, and how is this actually changing the world there? So I just feel so much more care in actually having a very developed world, even though it's a true melting pot of ideas. And I feel Malifaux does the same thing.
It definitely does. I'd be curious to know if you've ever read any of the Riverworld books by Philip Jose Farmer.
I'm not familiar with that one, but I'll write that down.
Yeah, write it down. And this is me showing my age because those are older books. But I didn't connect it with Discworld, but I get what you're saying, and I agree with you. What Malifaux reminded me of is Riverworld, which is a series of books, and God, I think there might be a dozen of them, written by Jose Farmer. And basically, instead, when people die, they go to this world that's basically a river, and everybody who's ever lived and ever died is there. And you'll have Mark Twain, you'll have Hitler, you'll have just an unbelievably eclectic group of characters. And depending on what book it is, depends on what character manifests there. But to the Discworld and the Pratchett analogy, there's intrigue, right? So you have individual characters that you care about, but yes, they're very different than other characters. And then you have the political aspect of it and the power struggles and stuff like that. So, yeah, if you haven't checked that out, you'll have to check that out. Just hearing you talk about Discworld, I'm like, oh, I wonder if he's read Farmer. I bet you'd like Farmer.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to look that up.
You should. You should. You have to let me know whether you read it. It makes me want to pull them back out again. But so I'd be curious, in the world itself of Malifaux, is there any particular characters that you feel, you already mentioned, you know, you feel a little bit of closeness to Leviticus. Is there anybody else that maybe you haven't written for yet that you would love to get a chance to write for?
Let's see here. So, yeah, I rank Leviticus highly, and just that outcast faction in general, it just communicates to me the most there. I've enjoyed reading the content for 10 Thunders. I was going to say Three Kingdoms, but no, 10 Thunders as a faction there. Ever since been to Japan and things like that, I've come back and just seeing, again, the little love letters that go to those pieces of lore there. That's one of my highest recommendations for adventures to play is the Obsidian Gate, that one of the most recent Pain Dreadfuls published there. It's a fantastic Pain Dreadful. So
just so you know, Nate Wolf, who's written a lot of the 10 Thunder stuff and helped with Obsidian Gate, while we're recording this, it hasn't been released yet, but I interviewed him.
Oh, neat.
And a real interesting guy. Cool. And it's neat that you like that aspect of it as well. So guys, we're going to take a quick break. When we get back from this break, I want to talk about his one shot. We're going to talk about Price of Progress. I want to learn what it's like to write an actual adventure for a role-playing game. So we'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Keith Suderman, and I'm a patron of Third Floor Wars. You'll never mistake me for a competitive player, but I really enjoy the analysis and the advice I get from Tabletop Talk. You should be a patron too. Head on over to patreon.com and search for Third Floor Wars, or just click the link in the show notes below.
Right now is the part of many podcasts where someone comes on, interrupts the show, and explains that you should consider paying for the content you're already getting for free. They'll go on and explain that by giving a dollar or more a month, you not only support the show, but you allow the show to grow and improve. Here on the Third Floor, we commit to not interrupting your episode of Tabletop Talk with such a plea. We pledge not to run a spot asking you to go to patreon.com and give a dollar or more a month. Even if there's a link in this show's description, and there is, we won't ask you to click it and become a patron. We won't spend time yammering about the benefits like early access to episodes, getting those episodes without ad breaks, or even getting a chance to play in one of Craig's RPG sessions. Anyway, enjoy this episode. We needed to clarify that we wouldn't do this type of solicitation.
I'd like to take a moment to give a shout out to some of the original patrons that started us on this journey. Special thanks to Jesse Ellis, Sam Newman, Nick Westbrook, Jim Ortiz, Kevin Smith, Keith Suderman, Matthew Riddle, Dane Leergard, Jeremy Peace, Wookie Gunner, Chris Blue, Vaslav, Kim Otto Nielsen, Rolf Randall, John Haas, Cody Hyatt, Michael Roper, Ambrose Ingram,
Pudgy Hobbit, Kaiser and Crimson, Brandon Sommer, Jason Reddy, Jason Burry, Kylie Woodland, Brian Schooner, Alan Voltz, and Owen. Because of you and the 100 other plus patrons, I'm able to put out content on a regular basis, and I appreciate it.
So it's one thing, you know, to write for NASA. It's another thing to, you know, write a story for one of the Chronicles. It's one thing to play through the breach. It's one thing to run through the breach. But creating an actual adventure, a one shot like The Price of Progress, that's got to be a very different thing. So first off, when did the opportunity to create a one shot come around?
Yeah, I believe the sequence events put out Sundial. It got published. Good feels all around there. But this was also the time where it was actually, I think, the second to last Weird Chronicles. Weird doesn't do Chronicles anymore. They were amping up for a third edition. So I actually hadn't heard from them for a while. And when I would put a feel out there, oh, we're busy, things like that. So it came to, I think it was the Christmas break, was like, hey, By the way, I don't really write when school's in session. It being a teacher is a full-time job, but yeah, at the same time,
it takes a few hours to be a teacher.
Yeah, especially now during COVID, piece of cake, no worries. But when it comes to kind of lengthy breaks and stuff, it's like, well, I would like to keep myself busy. Maybe they've got a project for me. So in one of those breaks, it was either Christmas or spring break, but it doesn't matter. Hey, do you have a project in mind there? Should I do another piece of lore? And they came back and said, well, actually, again, we trust you with Through the Breach here. Why don't you try your hand at a one shot? Particularly something, if you can, try and make it Condor Rails centric. Because also in the background, secretly, this was them amping up for Explorer Society.
Yep.
And they knew that Condor Rails was going to be its own faction there. It'd be nice if we had an adventure to kind of go along with that. So that was my prompt. That was it. Was, can you just do a one shot? Can you make it Condor Rails? And a second reason why they chose Condor Rails, there's a lot of existing lore about the rails in Into the Steam. Which is a Through the Breach source book there. So there's already quite a bit fleshed out of where it exists, again, in the kind of the environment of business inside Malifaux. There's a lot of names and how they operate there. But again, not that much lore, not that much as of yet generated for kind of gameplay content. So that was pretty much my prompt to start with.
So they come back to you with that, which I'm sure was exciting and daunting all at the same time, because this is going to be your first time, you know, actually writing of an adventure that potentially could get published. What's the first step? So you've got a basic theme, right? That you want to center it around. What's next?
So they came back with that, and it immediately sparked, or kind of reminded me of something else that's kind of been in the back of my brain all this time here, bringing it back to Soulstones. And it's the fact that when you say Soulstone Miner, what you see on the model and what is kind of expressed in the lore is what I'd argue is a vigorously kind of East Coast focus on what a miner is here. Here's a coal miner with a pickaxe, strong union. They're going deep below there. There's their miner helmet there. Like it speaks to what I would see in coal mines, 1910s, kind of East Coast there. But me being Californian, my high school's mascot is Miner. And what does that miner look like? It's this beard-faced claim jumper who is placer mining with a miner's pan and doesn't have any other gear and things like that. It's a completely different miner here. So that was something that kind of hit me. It's like, well, okay, well, why are they making this we want an adventure that's Condor Rails. Why are we putting down rails? It's all about the economy of Soulstones here. So why would they bring it down? There must be a new vein, new prospect there. So even though there was a focus on trains there, I kind of fell into this concept here. Well, I still want to focus on kind of the geology, the placer mining aspect there, and kind of throw in what a soulstone miner means to me, which is much more that kind of outcast prospector model. Going out there who might be, you know, illegally digging, not with a guild claim, but something along that realm there. So once they came back with that, I was like, well, there has been this system that I actually stumbled into with my Avatar game where my players had to do a far flung travel from one side of the continent to the other. How am I going to manage that? And so something that I've been really kind of focusing on lately as a GM and whatnot is how can I make non-combat kind of scenes a bit more interesting, because kind of the go-to, and this isn't just through the Breach, but even in D&D 5th Ed and others there, you have your ongoing skill challenge. And it's just that kind of go around the table, tell me what you did, roll d20, or flip cards, hit that TN, And that works up to a point, but I don't think anyone will make the claim that that is just as engaging or interesting or as dynamic as the system that is combat. So how can we make that a bit more, how can I elevate those kind of ongoing skill challenges to that quality there? So what I did for my Avatar game was I took the Fate deck when they're ready to fast travel here, and I flipped cards face down and until I made a silhouette that was the shape of the continent. And I told my players, okay, each card is about a day of travel. Let's go ahead and travel here. So they had to converse with themselves. Well, I want to scout ahead. Okay. With the twist deck flip for me there, you get to peek what the next card is. Oh, that's really low. Maybe we should avoid that. This one's really high. Well, that's probably a town there. You can replenish resources and things like that. And athletics was really high for everybody. You get to travel 2 days and reveal what's going on there. So that was a confirmation for me that, like, we can do more stuff with the Fate deck than we've kind of yet to see in other published works from Through the Breach. So that was my little kind of darling idea that I really wanted to inject in this adventure, is how can we do kind of interesting stuff like that and kind of inspire other readers of that story to do kind of similar systems and improve their ongoing skill challenges.
So that's interesting to me. So now we're at stage two. You've got the premise, right? They want it to be about the Condor Rails. You're going to involve, you know, soul stones in some way, and the mining of soul stones in some way. You've got a desire to flex the Fate deck in a way that maybe we've not seen yet in Through the Breach. How does it, like, I'm trying to figure out, like, where's the basic structure come from at that point? Like, where does the through line?
So at that point, that's when I was starting to put down my technical writing practice, where instead of, again, writing from beginning to end, I just had my different titles of scenes there. So here's scene one. Here's them getting a job from Condor Reels. Scene two, here's them prepping for that. Here's scene three. Here's them on the train to their destination, where they'll get off and continue surveying, laying down track or what have you. So I had these kind of story beats of this is why I want scenes, at that point, I started drawing stuff down, and I even put a few other systems on top of the one I just described in terms of, well, if you're purchasing things like dynamite and things like that, who's going to notice you doing that? Who's going to have opinions about that? Are you going to get a tail and whatnot? And we had kind of a feedback cycle there where some of these other kind of social challenges are like, this is a cute idea, might come back to it later, but for this adventure, it's not necessary in here. And so, you know, talk about killing off your darlings and things like that. Definitely had a couple moments of that, but in terms of how did I kind of not get disarmed by that? I still have those in my back pocket. So in a future writing scenario, I still have those in my repertoire. I still have those in my toolkit. Just because they didn't have a chance to shine in this particular one shot doesn't mean that I've lost the opportunity to use them again. So I think I wrote about 70% of an adventure. At that point, I had big gaping holes, which I just highlighted and just said, I think this is what's going to happen here. This master might show up, or this kind of confrontation, if you're interested. Kicked it back, and it came back, and they said, yeah, we like about, 30 or 40% of what you've got down there, That's preserve good. This and go that, and just iterate over and over again. And now we have the product we do.
So you're putting together set pieces, right? Mm-hmm. Essentially, is there a type of beginning, middle, end, act one, act two, act three, when you're putting together an adventure like that, something that you would think about when you're trying to structure a story? How do you structure that in the idea of, you're not telling the story, you're creating the stage, and you're putting in some props, and maybe you've got some costumes and some actors, but you're not telling the story. It's going to be the Fate Master and the players that tell the story. And I'd be interested in how you navigate that when you're creating an adventure, because if you get too far, it's just going to be a railroad, literally a railroad, that nobody's going to have fun playing, right? Because they have to go right. from A to B to C to D. Like, I really have no idea how you flex into that, because it seems very different to me.
Well, I think it helped that one of the core ideas that kind of came up was, this is a Condor Rails adventure where you are being, you the Fated, excuse me, are being commissioned by Condor Rails to effectively be a survey party for Condor. Why they're hiring you compared to someone else in-house, that's the big question there. But the point is, how you get there depends on what equipment they purchase and how they choose to get there. But more importantly, one of the first things I had a clear idea of was at the end, there was a chance of success or failure of this mission here. There, it is acceptable to fail at surveying the land here that was chosen, not necessarily because they failed to attempt it here, but just the land is bad. That is legitimately, we cannot have the weight of a train in this section here. We do not recommend to go across here. So having that as being my epilogue and knowing that is the case kind of gave me a bit of flexibility of, okay, there's a chance that when they are mining, surveying, or whatever, doing this sequence, there's a chance they fail by no choice of their own here, because that's how the cards laid. And
sure.
So how they kind of find that piece of land, if they kind of sense that, like, hey, this is bad, let's change positions, I give them opportunity to do that. Or if they dig deeper, there's consequences for that. So it's not just about story beats there. You also need to program in those kind of decision points there and have a cost and have consequences based on those choices from the players there, and just be okay with branching out multiple endings because right. of that.
So I'd be curious, there was a draft, it was submitted, you got some feedback, and then there was the last draft, mm-hmm. right? At some point you finished and they said, yep, we're going with this. This is a good to go. Was there anything that you did, changed, or put in there or took out that you can think of that really kind of pushed this thing over the finish line?
Honestly, to this day, I'm not quite sure, because what happened was I was just doing draft, and it did come to a point of, okay, now we're starting to care about word count, the size of this thing, trying to keep it within these particular constraints. And so their feedback and concerns became a bit more granular and fidelity there. And okay, can you be a little bit more specific about what critters should we put kind of in the back there, not just kind of hypotheticals and things like that. So one of the drafts I sent out, I was ready to just iterate again over and over again, but then I got an email back saying, nope, this looks good, we'll take it from here, edit it up as we see fit, we'll get the artists on it and bulk out the rest, your job is done. And it's just like,
that's awesome.
Oh, okay, I guess this has been decided for me, but I'm pleased that they're pleased. So
yeah.
I've kind of listened to your other creators chat about what was the decision point? What made you stop? And they keep on talking about, oh, it's so agonizing. If I had a chance, I still would iterate and improve it here. But that's kind of the beauty of being a freelancer is once the client's happy, great. They're happy then.
Yeah. Yeah. No, definitely. So I'd be curious, was there any last changes that you didn't see until the printed version came out?
So at the time of this recording, I haven't seen the finished product yet here. So it's going to be just as surprising here. I'm really interested to see if any art goes into it or any of the, or what art they do choose that's kind of existing to plug into it there. So I'm kind of waiting with bated breath to see what the end result looks like.
I bet you are.
Yeah.
So we're recording this at the end of February. When is this set to release? Do we have a release date yet?
Last I talked with them, it was either later this month or March. Q1 is what they said there. So
very nice. Very nice.
So it should be coming up.
Yeah. So for those of you listening, it's likely out already. And it's called The Price of Progress. Josh, it was great talking to you, man. I really appreciate it. It was interesting to kind of get a sense of your progress as a writer, as well as the, kind of your process, in creating these things. Let's go ahead and plug, what's out there for you. So we've got The Price of Progress, which is a one shot available through Weird Games. Which Chronicles is your story in?
I want to say it's either 36 or 37. It's the one that has Widow Weaver on the cover, so that's the Sundial. Yes.
Excellent. So the Sundial, and that can be picked up at DriveThruRPG, as well as Price of Progress can be ordered through Weird or through DriveThruRPG. Josh, is there any other shout outs or plugs that we want to fit in there as well?
Yeah, you probably already have the ad here, but Mario is a close friend of mine. So Matt's by Mars, get his product. It high quality, would recommend. But secondly, during these times of COVID here, I know it's really, really easy to kind of order your model from wherever and get it delivered to your door. But at the same time, like my FLGS is really suffering right now on top of COVID. They just got flooded for the second time from a door bust in Maine. And so there's still a truck in there. So really, unless you are ordering those, you know, Black Friday models or things like that stuff that you can only get from Weird, I highly, highly recommend just support your FLGS. That you want them there once everything returns back to normal here to have your play space and get back to playing like we all want to here. So if I can plug Astro Comics and Games of Medford, Oregon, and Funnigan Comics of Ashland, Oregon, those are the two that are kind of close to me here, and I hench at one. So, yeah.
I preached to that big time, Josh. In fact, I made a point about a month and a half into lockdown. I stopped ordering online, and I do everything now. I order more now through my local game store than I did pre-COVID, because of exactly what you're talking about. I knew it was going to be important for them to survive this. And when a lot of your business is just casual people playing and they go pick up something here, pick up something there, and that's gone. I completely appreciate that. Well, Josh, we'll have to figure out another reason to have you on the show, man. I appreciate you coming by.
Excellent. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And for those of you that stayed around to the end, thanks for listening. Take care. Hey, did you hear that? You leveled up. You finished another episode of Tabletop Talk from Third Floor Wars. If you want more from the Third Floor, follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Head on over to our YouTube channel. It is packed with painting tutorials, gaming tips, battle reports, and role-playing actual plays. Did you enjoy this episode? Why don't you send a link to one of your friends so they can enjoy it too? Last but not least, write us a review on your podcatcher of choice. This helps us find listeners almost as cool as you. All right, we ended up mashing together a couple segments there, man, but it was very organic.
Good, good, good.
So that was great. So this will probably be our last segment.
Totally.
But I want to dig into this because I haven't had anybody on yet that has walked through the process of creating an adventure. So that's where my focus will be. Okay.
No worries. That was kind of my hope in the first place, because playtesting models versus writing lore versus writing for Paint Dreadful one shots and things like that, it feels different each time.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, that's what we'll dig into. All right, I'll bring us back.
Cool.
you still here? Look, the podcast is over. And you sat through all of the breaks and bloopers? Well, I mean, if you're here, you might as well run over to patreon.com and become a supporter. Don't forget to rate and review this podcast, too, while you're at it, on whatever platform you're listening to. I do appreciate you sticking around. Take care.